Good evening, and thank you very much for this opportunity to come and share some time with you and speak with you this evening. It really is a privilege and a pleasure. Looking at your previous speakers who've stood here to address you and to discuss with you, I feel that I'm in very good company, perhaps very close company. As I understand it, Baroness Scotland, Patricia Scotland, was the first speaker in the series about a year ago. She was, of course, the Attorney General when I took up my post and remains a friend of mine. Professor Jeremy Horder, I think, then came. He and I studied the BCL together at Oxford, and he remains a friend of mine. I think you then had Michael Mansfield QC. Mike and I did several cases together, and you'll find my name in various points in his recent biography. I think, but for the snow, you would have had Vivian Stern, and you're going to have Vivian Stern later in the year. Vivian and I worked closely together on penal reform issues, and I called her husband as an expert witness in the Inter-American Court of Human Rights when we were challenging prison conditions in the Caribbean over there, and again, I see Vivian very often. Dominic Grieve, who you've most recently had, is of course the now Attorney General, and so I see Dominic on a regular basis in the superintendent's role. And finally, I think you're due to hear from Edward Fitzgerald in about a month. Ed and I have been close friends and colleagues for many, many years, and he did a hilarious speech at my wedding in 2007, so I'm sure you'll be hugely entertained by him. So as I say, I feel that I'm in good company and close company in the group of people that have come to address you. What I wanted to talk to you about tonight was disability hate crime and address and identify some of the issues involved in disability hate crime and suggest through the course of my lecture that a great deal of work remains to be done when it comes to disability hate crime, and it is, in many respects, the next frontier. John, not his real name, is a 45-year-old disabled man who lives alone. He was born with cerebral palsy. As a result, he has difficulty with walking and has to use a walking stick for support. Although he walks with an obvious limp and stumbles frequently, his independence is very important to him, so he tries to get out as much as possible. One afternoon, at approximately 3 o'clock, he was on his way to the local post office, which is about a 10-minute walk from his house, when he became aware of a group of youths, probably about five in number, who were milling around on the opposite pavement. He'd seen these young men frequently around the local area. He knows that they have a reputation locally for causing a nuisance. And indeed, they've shouted things at him in the past. On that afternoon, one of the group blocked his path and started to stare at him, whilst another member of the group started to abuse him about the way that he walked, and then started to mimic his movements by throwing his arms and legs around in an exaggerated way. Whilst this was happening, the other members of the group were laughing hysterically. John felt insulted, disgusted, and humiliated. The incident continued until a customer in one of the nearby shops intervened and told the youths to leave John alone. As John knew who the individuals were, he reported the incident to the police, and they were all subsequently arrested. But since the incident took place, John has felt unable to leave his flat on his own because he's afraid of a similar incident in future. Whereas he used to leave his flat several times a day to go to the local offices, to the police office, to the post office, or the local community drop-in centre, he now only goes out if accompanied by his social worker or his sister, who lives 10 miles away. His sister has got three young children to look after, and so he doesn't like to impose on her. And instead, he now spends days on end in his flat without seeing anyone. Today is the 2nd of March, 2011. You might think that the facts I've just set out relate to a different time or place, or perhaps that they're an account of an unusual occurrence. But I'm sorry to say that those facts are typical of the very many disability hate crimes that the Crown Prosecution Service deals with every year. And that's just the cases we know about. Although there is clear evidence that disability hate crime is widespread, I have no doubt in my mind that many thousands of cases go unreported year on year. The Disability Rights Commission's research into attitudes and awareness in 2003 revealed that 22% of disabled respondents had experienced harassment in public because of their impairment. Incidents of harassment were more acute amongst 15 to 34-year-olds, with 33% of this group of disabled people experiencing harassment. Research by the Greater London Action on Disability in 2001-2 found that 8% of disabled people in London suffered a violent attack, compared with 4% of non-disabled people. And they also found, and I quote, "The attacks have a major impact on disabled people. Around a third have had to avoid specific places and change their usual routines. One in four has moved home as a result of the attack." Research by MenCap demonstrated that 90% of people with learning disabilities had experienced bullying and harassment. 66% had been bullied regularly, with 32% stating that bullying was taking place on a daily or weekly basis. And research by Mind in 2007 and the Equality and Human Rights Commission in 2009 found similar rates of targeting. So that's the research. Yet the number of cases referred to the Crown Prosecution Service to consider for charging, although clearly rising, is very low. In 2007-08, we considered just 279 cases in England and Wales and charged 187 individuals with disability hate crime. In 2008-09, the corresponding figures were 444 considered and 292 charged. And in 2009-10, 720 were considered and 506 charged. Now, although there's no direct read across, and the temptation to draw comparisons should be resisted, the figures for other forms of hate crime are significantly different. So far as racially and religiously aggravated hate crime is concerned, to take the same periods, in 2007-08, the CPS considered 12,998 cases and charged 9,115 individuals with offences. In 2008-09, we considered 11,845 cases and charged 8,673. And in 2009-10, we considered 12,927 cases and charged 9,214. the numbers for homophobic hate crime are also higher. Again, for the same period, in 2007-08, the CPS considered 1,219 such cases and charged 758 individuals with homophobic hate crime. In 2008-09, we considered 1,090 cases and charged 710. And in 2009-10, we considered 1,300 cases and charged 907. And it's not just the total numbers that vary. The prosecution success rate for racially and religiously aggravated hate crime is 82.4%. For homophobic hate crime, it's 80.6%. Yet for disability hate crime, the success rate drops to 75.7%. So what is the cause of this phenomenon? Is it that disability hate crime is not properly recognised in law? I think not. Sections 145 and 146 of the Criminal Justice Act 2003 have placed a duty on courts to increase the sentence for any offence shown to be motivated by hostility based on the victim's actual or presumed race, religion, disability, or sexual orientation, or for any offence where a defendant demonstrably demonstrates hostility based on the victim's actual or presumed race, religion, disability, or sexual orientation. For the purpose of Section 146, disability means any physical or mental impairment, Section 146 also applies in cases where the offender has assumed a person is disabled, whether or not that assumption is correct. And the court must state in open court that the offence was committed in such circumstances. To my mind, applying as it does to all offences, this offers wide protection. However, others have observed that there is no offence of inciting hatred based on disability, which is in marked contrast to the position when it comes to inciting hatred based on race, religion, or sexual orientation. And in addition, it has been argued that there's an anomaly in Schedule 21 of the Criminal Justice Act 2003, which provides a high starting point of 30 years for murder that is racially or religiously aggravated or aggravated by sexual orientation, but no equivalent provision for murder that is aggravated by disability. If not the law, is there then a problem with the CPS policies when it comes to prosecuting disability hate crime? Again, I think not. In recognition of the particular complexities surrounding the prosecution of hate crime, the CPS has developed a suite of hate crime policies and guidance for prosecutors. All of these policies were developed with the involvement of specialist voluntary sector organisations and people directly affected by the policies. Each policy explains the relevant law, deals with the application of the Code for Crown Prosecutors, and sets out our approach to victims and witnesses and sentencing. And turning to a third possibility, there is clear evidence that it is possible successfully to prosecute disability hate crime. Let me make good that assertion by giving an example. A mother with her two children, a daughter who was 21 years old and visually impaired, and a son who was 16 and had Asperger's syndrome lived two doors from the defendant. They were subjected to a course of harassment over 9 months. The harassment came from a group of youths, the defendant being the main instigator and the ringleader. As well as verbal abuse, stones being thrown and damage to property, the defendant attacked the visual aid of the visually impaired woman, causing her to fall. And the verbal abuse included calling the daughter a fat pirate, she wore a patch, and the son was called a stupid fucking spacker. The CPS authorised a charge under Section 2 of the Protection from Harassment Act. The charging lawyer immediately identified this as a hate crime and referred to Section 146 of the Criminal Justice Act 2003 on the charging records. The defendant pleaded not guilty, and a full summary trial was conducted in the Magistrates Court in early 2010. The defendant was convicted and sentenced to 22 weeks detention, the maximum being 26 weeks. The court applied Section 146 at the sentencing stage and granted the application for a restraining order. The defendant appealed his sentence, and the CPS Area Hate Crime Coordinator conducted the appeal. On appeal in the Crown Court, the judge and the magistrates were appalled by the defendant's behaviour and dismissed the appeal. And at the conclusion of the case, the mother rang the witness care service and thanked the witness care unit for the work that they had done. So, assuming then that Section 146 properly recognises disability hate crime, that CPS policies are clear and robust, and that it is possible successfully to prosecute disability hate, the search for an answer to the question of why so few cases reach court and succeed leads inevitably to wider and more profound questions, which touch on the confidence that disabled people have in our criminal justice system and the linked issue of whether there is sufficient support for disabled victims and witnesses where cases go to court. I don't pretend to have full answers to these questions, and I will not attempt to provide a comprehensive analysis of the problem. But it does seem to me that the following points have some validity. First, the idea of people being targeted as a victim of crime because of their disability is still relatively new. It is not fully understood by the general public, and perhaps more surprisingly, it is not always recognised by the victims of such behaviour or by those with responsibility for dealing with it. Many disabled people do not appreciate that constant name-calling, mimicking, and bullying, which often escalates to more serious forms of harassment and violence, are criminal offences. That may be because such behaviour is so widespread as to be considered routine. Unless we as a society recognise and confront this issue, there is little prospect of more cases coming into the system, and we'll have missed a valuable opportunity to tackle this important area. And even where disability hate crime is reported, those with responsibility to deal with it often advise victims to ignore all but the most serious incidents. No one needs reminding of the facts of the Fiona Pilkington case, widely reported last year. And then there is the difficulty in distinguishing hostility from vulnerability. In my view, it is important to recognise the difference between a vulnerable person and a vulnerable situation. Let me put this in context. An able-bodied young person attacked while walking along a dark alleyway at night would not be described as a vulnerable person. But a disabled person who's abused for being disabled and then assaulted in broad daylight on their way home could well find the offence committed against them classified as an assault on a vulnerable person rather than a disability hate crime. Calling a person vulnerable can confuse or conflate their situation with their identity. Vulnerability is then seen as an innate characteristic of disabled people. In fact, we can all feel vulnerable in different situations and at different times in our lives. The challenge is to recognize that people can be vulnerable because they are in poor situations. By identifying a situation rather than an individual as vulnerable, we place the blame firmly on the perpetrator, the one who exploited the situation and is all the more culpable for it. Returning to the question, another factor that we have to recognise when dealing with the confidence that disabled people have in the criminal justice system is that even when action is taken and cases proceed to court, we as prosecutors are not exempt from criticism. Evidence from the voluntary sector organisations and the High Court decision in the case of FB 2 years ago suggests that prosecutors may be too ready to assume in some cases that victims and witnesses with disabilities are not reliable enough for a case to succeed, or that, even if reliable, they would not be able to give evidence in a way which would be accepted by a jury. We also need to get ourselves better organised at flagging and recognising and recording disability hate crime. Now, we've worked hard recently to deal with these issues, primarily within the CPS core quality standards that I've introduced and through the monitoring of the cases that we handle. There is, of course, support that can be given to victims and witnesses with disabilities, and they're quite capable of giving evidence which is not only reliable, but compelling. The Youth Justice and Criminal Evidence Act 1999 allows special measures to be used to help vulnerable and intimidated witnesses give evidence. The measures, as you know, include the use of screens, giving evidence by live link, giving evidence in private in sexual offences cases, video recording evidence in chief, examination through an intermediary, and communication aids. Witness care units were introduced in England and Wales in 2005. They are staffed by the police and the CPS and provide victims and witnesses of crime with support before they go to court, in particular information about the progress of their cases. And they can refer victims and witnesses to specialist support services where appropriate. And in 2008, pre-trial witness interviews were introduced. These can take place in any case in which the prosecutor considers an interview would assist in assessing the reliability of a witness's evidence and or to assist in understanding complex evidence. The purpose is to enable the prosecutor to reach a better informed decision about any aspect of the case. And these interviews are often used to assess the needs of disabled witnesses in order to ensure that the correct support is provided for the trial process. I have no doubt that by making best use of this sort of support, our prosecutors can make a real difference. Let me give you an example. in the case of James Michael Watts last year, the defendant was convicted of a number of sexual assaults upon severely disabled women with profound communication issues. The victims gave their evidence by blinking or pressing buttons on their wheelchair to indicate yes or no. They were believed by the jury, and the defendant was convicted, and his subsequent appeal was dismissed by the Court of Appeal. The CPS viewed this as a particularly significant achievement. But it is interesting to note, as reported in The Guardian in June 2010, under the headline, and I quote, "Jim Watts is serving 12 years for abusing disabled women, but is he a victim of a miscarriage of justice?" question mark, that the defendant's legal team argued on appeal that the victims were not safe witnesses. There's clearly more work to do. The case of Christopher Killick, which was concluded in December last year, is just as interesting. Initially, the CPS took the view that it was a case that could not be prosecuted. But on review, we changed our mind and brought charges. Mr. Killick, who himself is physically disabled, subjected his two male victims, who had cerebral palsy, to appalling acts of sexual violence over a prolonged period of time. He specifically selected his victims because he knew that they would be physically unable to resist him, and because he knew how difficult it would be for them to complain to others about what had happened to them. He also knew how emotionally vulnerable they were, as they lived in somewhat isolated worlds and only socialized with a small group of people. The victims were wheelchair users and could not communicate without the use of voice machines or the help of intermediaries. But the prosecution and the court overcame these difficulties. A pre-trial hearing was held with the judge to set timetables allowing for frequent breaks. Bliss symbols were designed to enable the victims to answer questions in detail using those symbols. And screens were put in place to shield the victims from the defendant when they gave evidence. These examples show that we've come a long way from the days when a criminal case was considered to be a contest between the state and an individual defendant, with only an unsupported walk-on part for victims and witnesses. The right of victims to an effective investigation and appropriate prosecution is now well established under the Human Rights Act 1998, and the support available by way of special measures underscores the growing realization that victims and witnesses have rights and interests that have to be protected in the criminal justice process, not just, as was often understood to be the case in the past, merely a duty to attend to give evidence. But despite these developments, I think we are still in the foothills when it comes to disability hate crime and supporting victims and witnesses with disabilities. The current inquiry by the Equality and Human Rights Commission into disability-related harassment and how well this is being addressed by public authorities is welcome. The CPS has given evidence to the inquiry and will consider carefully its findings in due course. Our position is, I hope, clear. Safety and security and the right to live free from fear and harassment are fundamental human rights. Disability hate crime strikes at all disabled people by undermining their sense of safety and security in the community. For this reason, disability hate crime should be regarded as particularly serious. Such crimes are based on ignorance prejudice, discrimination, and hate when they have no place in an open and democratic society. Securing the confidence of those affected by disability hate crime and those that are targeted because of their perceived vulnerability because they are disabled is critical to the fulfillment of our duty to ensure that all people have equal access to justice. We as prosecutors have made good progress recently. We have new monitoring procedures in place to check our performance, and we can look back on some of our recent cases with pride. Having recognised that victims and witnesses have rights and interests, as well as duties, that we need to go on to ensure that we're listening carefully to what they have to say. To that end, we continue our work with colleagues in the criminal justice system and the voluntary and community sectors at national and local levels to develop best practice, and we will regularly review our policies in this area to ensure that we offer the best possible service to the disabled community. We should not underestimate the task ahead, and as I've already said, it is for society too to confront this issue. But we would all do well to recognise that to date, victims and witnesses with disabilities have not been well served by the criminal justice system. Thank you very much.